A bill in Tallahassee goes after teens who post pictures of themselves with illegal guns. Some Republicans are supporting it. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Senate bill would allow police to arrest a juvenile who possesses an illegal firearm if they post pics of themselves with those guns on social media. The NRA is pushing back. Also, Fort Lauderdale has a big problem with an old sewage and water pipe system.
The frequency of the breaks is alarming, and I'm not sure why that is, because it's not that it's happening in any one part of the city, it's happening in many different parts of the city.
We'll hear from Mayor Dean Trantalis on how much longer residents will have to deal with sewage spills. Finally, we had a live event with Craig Pittman at Books and Books this past weekend. His new book, Cattail, profiles the smorgasbord of characters who all played a critical role in saving the Florida Panther. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Law enforcement is increasingly using social media as a tool to combat crime. A new bill in the Florida legislature could expand those abilities. State Senator Jason Pizzo, a Democrat from Miami-Dade County, has filed a bill that would allow cops to arrest a teen who posts photos on social media with an unlicensed firearm. The bill has passed a Senate subcommittee but is facing criticism from the NRA and other gun advocacy organizations. Mary Ellen Kloss is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald, and she joins us now. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure.
Hello, good to be with you.
So help me understand this, how this legislation is meant to work. Police are scrolling through social media. Let's say I'm a teen, I post a picture with myself and a gun, and then what could they do to me?
Well, if police see the social media and they can now make an arrest because it's illegal in Florida law to possess a firearm unless you're target shooting or you're hunting with an adult. So if a teen poses with a firearm on social media, the police can suspect that that is an illegal possession and begin the investigation process. They'll first need to confirm that indeed the person was underage, and they'll use social media probably as their evidence that they were illegally possessing it. What's different here is that they don't need a warrant for an arrest. They can just go and knock at someone's door and arrest them.
Is it common for law enforcement to scroll through social media to get information on suspects?
Yes. It's my understanding. I spoke with Senator Pizzo, who's a former prosecutor, and it's very common for law enforcement because they're watching activity, they're watching gang activity and criminals. And so they monitor social media carefully. It's also when they arrest juveniles, often juveniles will talk about what they've seen on social media. So they gather evidence that way.
Senator Pizzo is behind this legislation. Why? Why is this important to him?
You know, he has a really interesting story. He is a former prosecutor. He worked almost exclusively on homicides and investigated and prosecuted many homicides, except one of the things that frustrated him so much is that there were many victims who were murdered in drive-by shootings, other kinds of situations, and never got... they were never able to get enough evidence to convict anyone. So he said, you know, one of the hardest things of his job was this Tuesday evening meeting at Miami-Dade County's Northside Police Station, in which the mothers of these murdered children would meet to kind of provide support for each other. And whenever he'd ask them to raise their hands, you know, out of a group of about 20 mothers, maybe one or two could say that they've actually had the killer of their child convicted.
So basically, we're talking about you have a situation where, for example, like in the Parkland shooting, we saw the Parkland shooter posting pictures and videos of him with guns, but also in communities, especially communities of color, we do see gang retaliation and gang threats. Again, people posting pictures of themselves with guns, making those threats.
Right. And, this is not likely to be the end and solution for a lot of these problems, but it does give law enforcement one more tool. And that is his argument, is that he wants to just have another way to go after these kids. And potentially, if they know that a police can arrest them for showing off with a gun on social media, maybe he's hoping that they'll be less likely to keep it close and hang around with it. He hopes there's some deterrent effect.
Yeah. Now, obviously, lobbying groups like the NRA have argued that the language of the bill isn't specific enough. And they argue, for instance, that a teen could be posing with a gun after going hunting or, that they like to sport shoot. How has Bizzo responded to that criticism?
Well, his argument is that it's already legal for gun owners to, show a prize they won from a hunting competition or show, a dead animal that they've killed in a hunt. There's nothing wrong with that as long as the person legally was, was using the gun with an adult or in a shooting competition, something like that. So his argument is that it's already legal for them to do this and that the way this is written, this is not going to go after those people. Now, the NRA says that it's still too broadly written, that this will be an excuse for law enforcement to go after law-abiding kids. That is the argument the NRA always uses, is that they're concerned about, law-abiding citizens who are using guns. So I think that their argument is pretty expected.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Mary Ellen Claus. Again, a new bill would allow law enforcement to arrest juveniles if they're found posting on social media with unregistered guns. Again, it's illegal for anybody under 18 to have one. But you can find more of our legislative coverage by going to WLRN.org. What have we heard from law enforcement, the Police Benevolence Association? How do they feel about this?
I haven't heard whether or not he's gotten much input from them. It's my sense that he does have the support of prosecutors and law enforcement generally. I also think there is some reluctance to go up against the NRA if it can be, misrepresented by the NRA and shown that they're going after legal possession of guns. So for that reason, I think he still faces a bit of an uphill battle.
Is this unique, for Florida to have this? Is there any other state that has anything like this?
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Senator Pizzo about that, and I do think it's worth investigating. It's interesting because this really stems from his own personal experience and his frustration in watching kids talk about other kids with guns and having absolutely no way to go after them unless he could prove that it was used in a crime.
Yeah. Now, this passed the Senate Judiciary Committee, but again, we're talking about a Republican-controlled House and Senate. Is he optimistic that this could get through to in this session?
Well, he did attempt something similar to this last session, and the NRA said it was just too broadly written, and I think even social media platforms were somewhat opposed to it. So he completely started from scratch, just turned it into an opportunity for law enforcement to arrest people, and didn't make it illegal to post it on social media. It's just using if you do post it on social media, you can. It's an opportunity for law enforcement to open the door to an investigation. So it's changed dramatically from in the past, and he is hoping that it'll get through a couple more Senate committees. But here's the reality. It's got a really long way to climb just to get through the Senate, and it does not even have a House companion. He's hoping that if the Senate says it's a good idea, then he'll persuade the House to take it up. But I think that's pretty wishful thinking.
And, you mentioned it already. I mean, the NRA's power over the legislature, we've seen, any action on their part, and not just arguing against the bill, but on pressing legislators.
Yeah, and you know, this is the NRA has spooked a lot of people in an election year, and so there are many Republican legislators, especially, who do not want to get them mad. So if there's any doubt that they will go against him for supporting this bill, you know, it's possible that they won't advance it. But what was very interesting is that this bill was before the Judiciary Committee, and yes, it is got a lot of Republicans. It's led by a Republican, and it passed unanimously. So among those that get this, there was Republican support.
We've been talking with Mary Ellen Kloss, the Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lewis. My pleasure.
Well, still to come, Fort Lauderdale is sitting on an aging and constantly breaking sewage pipe system. We're going to hear from the mayor about when all of this is going to get fixed. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Fort Lauderdale has struggled with its aging water and sewage system for the past several months, and the problem doesn't appear to be getting better. Just this past weekend, there were two pipe breaks in the city, and one more was being repaired by Fort Lauderdale crews last night in the Rio Vista neighborhood. The breaks have required boil water notices for residents and health concerns about exposed raw sewage. Some residents are asking the city to put a moratorium on new development before addressing the city's aging infrastructure. Earlier this morning, we spoke with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantelis about the sewage crisis. Two more water pipes break this weekend, two neighborhoods under a boil water notice. Every time you hear another story of a pipe break, what's going through your mind?
I feel terrible about the neighbors that are victims of these situations, and but I do know that the city, our city staff, is prepared to respond to each and every one of them. I feel good to know that we have the capability of responding in a quick and resolute way, and we are prepared for the next break. And we know that they're going to continue to happen because of the aging infrastructure that we have, infrastructure that was neglected for many, many years. And this is our attempt to try to resolve it as quickly as possible. But again, the impact on our community is where I feel it the most. And the frequency of the breaks is alarming. And I'm not sure why that is, because it's not that it's happening in any one part of the city. It's happening in many different parts of the city. We did have breaks over the last several years. No one seems to understand why they're happening so often. And it's whether it's a sewer break or a water break, we are suffering the consequences of a neglected policy, which indicated that, you know, we were just going to patch things up and never really respond to the demand that is necessary in a growing city.
You've argued in the past, though, that past administrations kind of just kicked this can down the road, and that they were taking basically the funds for water and sewer and using it somewhere else. What were they doing with the money?
Well, what they were doing with the money was they were balancing the budget. We never really had a balanced budget for many years. And the way that we were able to shore up the deficiency was to take money from various enterprise funds, including the Water and Sewer Fund, but not exclusively that fund, and putting it into the general fund to make ends meet. And that included, we've seen record increases in police and fire compensation packages. You know, we just saw spending that should not have taken place over the last decade as it had. The previous administration really had no understanding of the true impact of the policies that were being practiced over these many years. To say that we didn't know where to spend the money when we're spending it tens of millions of dollars by the month just trying to make up for lost time, it shows that how out of touch the previous administration was in terms of trying to address the challenges and the imperatives that we have with our infrastructure situation.
You did say we. I mean, you were on the commission. I mean, you know, did you foresee any of this? You know, as again, as you're sending money off into other places for the general fund, But did you not foresee this, knowing that our system is old and it's going to break down at some point?
Well, a commission can only respond to what the management tells us. They give us the facts and the figures, and we set policy based on information given to us. When I turned course was when we had that huge sewer break in Tarpon River, and I realized once and for all that we were being lied to, and that this turn on investment scheme was actually starving our water and sewer fund from the funds necessary in order to respond to the need that we had. So it was a major campaign issue, in fact, when I ran for mayor, because I realized and the community was realizing that, you know, we were being lied to and that the needs of the city's infrastructure were not being addressed. So going forward, we're now really less focused on what happened in the past. Let's learn from our mistakes and let's see how we can try to achieve results with with our new administration, with a new focus, and with a new attention to not just patching up old pipes, but replacing them with redundant systems so that we don't have problems in the future, and putting Fort Lauderdale on a solid footing going forward in the next generation.
What are officials telling you about the system as it is right now? And I'm wondering, because you look at what happened in December and January, are we close to one catastrophic event that leaves all your residents without access to water?
The access to water situation occurred when there was an accident, when FPNL dug into a pipe that was by accident. That was not aging infrastructure. So the aging infrastructure that we are now suffering from has been mostly the sewer system. But it doesn't mean that we still don't have aging infrastructure in our water system. I cannot predict where the next leak is going to take place, where the next pipe break is going to take place, but I do know that we are intending to spend close to $600 million over the next 5 years to address this problem. In a town hall meeting we had 3 weeks ago, we laid out a complete program in terms of water, sewer, stormwater. We're not taking this challenge lightly. We are moving quite aggressively to make Fort Lauderdale the sustainable city that it is and will soon become, and so that we can continue to respond to the growth that we continue to experience here in Fort Lauderdale.
And you know, you talked about you don't want to do a patchwork. You don't just want to fix. You want to replace and build a better system. Are you talking about a complete overhaul of the system in place now?
Well, you cannot do a complete overhaul of the system overnight. You know, it takes time. We have a very complicated, multi-layered, expansive system. What we can do is we can first address the main trunk lines, the main water and sewer lines. In fact, the one we're dealing with right now is the one on the east side of town that goes from the George Lohmeyer treatment plant down on 17th Street Causeway all the way up to the Coral Ridge Golf Course. That's an important trunk line. We're going to put a brand new line in, and then once that is installed, we're going to go back and rehabilitate the current line, reline it with a liner, so that we have two in place and we don't have to worry about the problem that we just experienced in December.
And is that the $65 million reconstruction package? Again, that's for the sewage main. Is that what you're talking about?
That is correct. But we have several sewage mains through the city, and much of that infrastructure has actually already taken place, especially through the downtown where we see a lot of the new development. A lot of the infrastructure has already been put in place, new pump stations, new main lines, force mains have been put in place. We have less experience with breakage in those areas than we are experiencing on the east side, where that had been neglected for many years and had never been touched.
I wanted to get a sense of the figures, though, because I've seen $600 million investment, over $1.5 billion. What are we looking at? I mean, the whole thing over the next two decades, what is the city going to have to spend?
I don't know the answer to that question because I don't think we know the answer to that question.
I'm speaking with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantalis. The city of Fort Lauderdale has been experiencing a number of sewage breaks over the past couple of months, including two more this past weekend. You can find more coverage of Fort Lauderdale sewage problems by going to WLRN.org. And what is your take on Governor Ron DeSantis not too long ago basically saying that he wants to punish cities, for not fixing their infrastructure and allowing for basically for sewage water to get into waterways and into neighborhoods? And I wanted your take on that. Do you think that that's fair?
Well, we don't need a lesson from the governor on how to take care of our resources. What we do need is a helping hand. And if all they are interested in is punishing cities, I would ask them to sit back and reflect on how important it is for the state to participate in helping cities trying to overcome their infrastructure problems and assisting us financially in trying to address those needs. So to sit back and say, I'm just going to punish you for failing to address these needs, I think is the wrong stance to take. I see the governor gets a lot of great headlines for spending hundreds of millions of dollars for the Everglades, and that too is important. But the reality is that cities are struggling. Cities cannot rely entirely on the monies that we derive from our water and sewer ratepayers and our taxpayers. And considering that Broward County in particular is a donor county where we send more money up to Tallahassee than we get back, I truly believe that we need to have a conversation with the administration in Tallahassee to come to terms on what our expectations are of Tallahassee, and instead of trying to punish people, try to work together and make things happen here.
Has the state not assisted in any way?
Not in any measurable way. They come down here and they enforce consent decrees on us, and they threaten us that if you don't get things done in a certain time frame, then we're going to fine you. You know, spending money on fines does not help the problem. Using that money to rebuild infrastructure is the solution. So I would like to think that we can work hand in hand with the Department of Environmental Protection to try to make sure that we can ensure that the health, safety, and welfare of our communities are addressed. You know, because my biggest concern in the end is the impact on our natural resources. We must now focus on our natural resources, our waterways, our everything, our estuaries, our marshlands, our beaches. That's the lifeblood of our community. And if until we focus on that, we're never really going to have accomplished what we need to accomplish. And again, I would call upon the governor and his colleagues in Tallahassee to work hand in hand with us to try to ensure that we can improve upon the waterways in particular to return sea life and wildlife to our areas.
Let me move to this is a growing argument with some of your residents. They feel that there's just too much growth. And this goes back to whether the sewage system and the water pipes can handle this growth. And there have been some people who have asked for a moratorium on development. What's your take on that?
So we've been hearing that as well, and it's a very honest question to ask. So we have an infrastructure task force committee made up of some very talented people in our community, and we have asked them to investigate what are the sources of these breakages. You know, going forward, how does new growth impact the infrastructure? So, if a moratorium is an answer, then we want them to at least investigate it and see if, in fact, it will have a measurable impact on our infrastructure. You know, we're not just going to run helter skelter into making decisions like that. But with the talent pool that we have in our community, our neighbors are really excited about discussing this, investigating it, and coming back to the commission with recommendations. And if one of those recommendations happens to be a moratorium or a pause on development, then we'll certainly address it. The commission itself is not going to initiate anything yet until we hear from the community.
I just wanted your take on that idea, though, and beyond just the old structure infrastructure beneath us, just the fact that traffic's an issue, sea level rise is an issue. What do you think about that idea that maybe South Florida at some point reaches that barrier where you can't really keep growing anymore?
The thing is that growth will continue to happen in Florida. You know that over 900 people a day are moving into the state. Where are they going to go? Should they come to Fort Lauderdale? Should they come to Miami? Should they go to Lake Placid? I don't know the answer, but I do know that if right now Fort Lauderdale is in a growth phase, and in many ways it's the growth here is trying to eliminate a lot of the slum and blight that has existed within our city for many, many years. And if we stop the continual building and don't allow for more units to come into our city, it's going to tighten the inventory and it's going to drive prices up even more than they are today. And so Fort Lauderdale will become even more unreachable by people, young people, working people, people who just will never be able to afford to live in the city. So there are unintended consequences to moratoriums. So that's why we've tasked the Infrastructure Task Force to come up with some solutions, knowing that there are pros and cons to each recommendation.
You know, as we move forward, you said it yourself. I mean, you're telling people these pipes are going to break because it's an old system. And it's not just your city. It's many parts of South Florida and Florida in general have old systems. But, you know, I wanted to know what the communication is like with communities in warning people ahead of time of what the dangers are, or getting to these places as quickly as possible, to fix them as quickly as possible. Are those systems in place? Are you confident that communication is there?
I'm very confident in the competence of our staff. We have to still concern ourselves with traffic and transportation. That's why we're working hand in hand with the MPO and the county in trying to formulate ideas in order to make traffic flow, in order to get people out of their cars.
What's the best way to reach people? Are you doing it just by, sending the message out to the media or on Facebook? How do you reach the communities when there's a problem?
We send out a voicemail throughout the community. We have a recorded message alerting people what's going on. Also on Facebook, I have the mayor's page, and we send out a notice as several times a day. Each of the commissioners do the same. They send out messages through their Facebook list. And so through the media, we are constantly in touch through your station, other stations, the print media. We do our best to try to get the message out. Plus, we have neighborhood meetings. We are constantly meeting with our neighbors, our homeowners associations, our civic associations. We are around the clock communicating with folks in the city, and I'd like to think that we're succeeding in that regard. But you know, if someone feels left out, you know, we need to reach out even farther and try to include them in the messaging.
That was my conversation with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trantalis. You can find more coverage at Fort Lauderdale sewage problems by going to WLRN.org. Well, still to come, have you ever seen a live Florida panther? We spoke with author Craig Pittman about the February book club title, A Cat's Tale. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, let's play a little trivia. Do you know what Florida's state animal is? Think about it. All right. If you guess the Florida panther, you're right on. But do you know how it became the state animal? Well, the Florida panther is the central character of Craig Pittman's new book called Cattail, The Wild, Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. The book tells a story of how Florida's state animal was at the brink of extinction. Over the course of his environment reporting with the Tampa Bay Times, Craig interviewed a group of oddball characters, including a panther hunter, biologist, and veterinarian, that were essential in saving it. Cattail is Sundial's Book Club February title. We recorded our conversation with Craig at an event this past Saturday at Books and Books in Coral Gables. And you can see the Facebook Live of the event and join our book club by going to Facebook and searching for the Sundial Book Club.
I grew up in Pensacola, up in the north end of the state, where if there's wildlife, you hunt it. And we didn't have any panthers up there, so I didn't really pay much attention to them. But when I started working at what was then the St. Petersburg Times and covering environmental issues, one of the first stories I wrote was about panthers. And I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. And the more I wrote about panthers over the space of about 20 years, each time I think, wow, this story is great. This would make a great book. There's oddball characters. There's twists and turns in the plot you wouldn't expect. But it didn't have an ending. I had to kind of wait. And finally, about 3 years ago, I got a good ending. And I thought, okay, now I can sit down and write.
But as you're putting it together, I mean, how did you decide, or maybe it was the publisher, how did you decide how you wanted to organize it? Was it just a chronological story? Was it that easy? Or because, I mean, look, the character is the panther.
Yeah. I started off writing it all chronological, and then I realized, no, I need to have the most dramatic scene of all. I need to put that right at the beginning of the book so people would see that and go, you know, wow, this is pretty amazing. And so the book actually opens with a prologue where they're chasing down this panther with dogs and trying to hit it with a tranquilizer dart, and things go horribly awry. And I think that kind of helps set the tone for both the characters and the plot.
There is also a scene, too, by the way, where someone gives CPR to a panther.
Mouth-to-mouth.
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 Yes,
yeah,
mouth-to-mouth.
Which, honestly, is a commitment to the job you seldom see in America these days.
That is true.
Yeah.
You know, the two things about this book, I mean, it talks about kind of the attitudes that people in general had about the panther people have started settling in Florida.
Right.
And also the different characters. But let's talk about that, because the first people who start coming to Florida pretty much look at the area as a wasteland. Let's tear it all down, mm-hmm. drain it, kill everything in it, because we got to develop.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden attitudes change.
Right.
And it was the same with the panther, because at the beginning everybody just wanted to hunt it. It was in the way.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back to our original inhabitants, the Calusa, the Tocobaga, they venerated the panther. They thought it was a divine being. In fact, the Seminoles thought it was the first thing ever created. But then the Spanish came, and they referred to them as lions and catamounts, which, by the way, is a great term I would love to see brought back. And then our early settlers were absolutely petrified of these things. They thought that they would come in and kill all their cattle, kill all their scrawny children, you know, and just wipe them out. So whenever they saw a panther, their first reaction was to shoot it. And like you said, a lot of people just sort of said, you know, let's get rid of them. The legislature even had a bounty on the panther's head for a while of $5 per head, which in our dollars would be $100. So, you know, you could see why a lot of people shot panthers. But then, you know, we got to the point of where people started being concerned about the environment, and the big event in Florida was the effort to build what they call the Everglades Jet Port. They wanted to build, the Miami-Dade Port Authority wanted to build the largest airport in America in the middle of the big cypress swamp, because they figured, well, nobody lives out there, so nobody will object, right? But an odd coalition of hunters and activists and people who just like the Everglades got together, and they recruited this old woman in a floppy hat named Marjorie Stoneman Douglas to help them. And they managed to stop the jet port and preserve Big Cypress, which, as it turned out, was one of the last remaining pieces of habitat for panthers. And that sort of started to change things in Florida. Should I go on or should I stop?
No, well, okay. you could go okay. on. But then they wouldn't buy the book because you just told the whole story.
That's true. Spoiler alert.
But, you know, it's fascinating when you see that side of the story and you see how attitudes of residents, the attitudes for residents change over time. And all of a sudden, there's this love and compassion for the species and for the Everglades, and now people want to fight to protect it. But there's so many fascinating characters. All of them play an important role. Without mm-hmm. them, we probably don't have the panther.
Yeah.
I want to talk about my favorite one, Roy McBride.
He's a great character.
He was a hunter. He was a hunter, and mm-hmm. they brought him in to help protect the panther. When this is a guy who spent his life basically killing him.
Right. Right.
So, all right, so explain that one. How in the world is a hunter, he had a change of heart?
Roy's this fascinating guy who grew up in Texas, in very rural Texas, and he told me that where he grew up, you only had three choices for a job. Either you worked on the sheep farm raising the sheep, or you chased down the predators that were killing the sheep, or you left town. And so Roy became a guy who hunted the predators. He became an expert tracker, an expert hunter. He knew how to find wolves. He knew how to find the mountain lions in Texas. And so when the Endangered Species Act passed, panthers were on the original endangered species list, along with, you know, manatees and keedeer. And a lot of supposedly smart Florida officials said, well, we don't think they belong in there because we think they're already extinct. We think you're wasting your time trying to protect them. And so the World Wildlife Fund hired Roy for $500 to come to Florida and see if there were any panthers left. And he found one, a scrawny female. He found signs there might be others. He figured there might be 20 tops left in Florida. And Roy is like my Zelig, you know, like the Woody Allen movie. Every time there's an important thing that happens involving panthers, Roy was there. He popped up playing this important role. And he told me that he had sort of shifted his sympathies because he could see what the sheep were doing to the landscape in Texas where he grew up. And he got to where he kind of liked the predators more. He'd started thinking like them and following them around. And so when he discovered there were still panthers left in Florida, he became this guy that they turned to a lot in trying to study them and learn about them and figure out what they needed in order to be protected and saved.
He's really a colorful character. I love the way how you write to describe who these people are. And I made the joke with you. I said, if you made a movie today, what actor, and I didn't specify alive or dead, what actor plays him?
That's the key.
Who did you pick?
I think it was Brad Pitt, but looking like he does in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where he's kind of got that weathered look, like, you know, like Robert Redford, like he's somebody's been tanning his hide for a while.
And I said he is the typical Chuck Connors guy.
Yeah.
And if you don't know who he is, please, he's
the rifleman. He's the rifleman.
He has that Western American man look with the broad shoulders and the big jaw. He's that guy.
He was also an Airplane.
How did the panther become the state animal?
Oh, this is a great story.
I love this one.
All right, so there was a move afoot in the legislature to name a state animal. And the guy who was then the Secretary of Education for Florida, a guy named Ralph Turlington, whose nickname is Ralph Turtleburger because he talks so slow, Turlington thought it would be smart to have the state school children vote on what should be the state animal. And so he drew up a ballot and sent it out to all 67 counties and said, please have your school children vote on this. And the choices on there, they had some write-in spaces, but the choices were the alligator, the manatee, the dolphin, and the panther. And nobody expected the panther to win. But this was at the same time that the state's first panther expert, a guy named Chris Belden, who had never actually seen a panther, was trying to find where the panthers lived. And so he was going on this very public quest to find panthers and asking people to help him. He was giving speeches. He was writing articles for magazines and so forth. And every time these things would run, they would run a picture of this beautiful panther, this sleek predator. And it sort of caught the public imagination, and people started really sort of falling in love with this beautiful panther. And so the fact that there was this beautiful animal and that it was very endangered really caught the public's imagination. And so when the kids voted, they voted overwhelmingly to make the panther the state animal. And it surprised everyone. And so then they sent it along to the legislature in 82 to ratify it. And some of the legislators refused. And they said, everybody knows the gator is Florida's state animal. I think they were all UF grads. The school children went nuts and bombarded the legislators with angry letters saying, how dare you try and overturn our election? You asked us what we should pick. This is what we picked. Don't back off. And they said, okay. And they approved it. They officially, in 1982, made the panther Florida state animal. And as a result, the panther started getting a lot more attention from the legislature and from scientists. And that's really, I think, what saved them is the fact that they were the official state animal, and it would look really bad for Florida if the state animal went extinct. So that's why I say the school children really are the ones that saved it.
That was 82. Do you remember what age group they were sending, what age, grade level they were asking kids?
I think it was like fourth or fifth grade. Fourth a friend of mine told me he remembers this, and he remembers that in his class, the teacher actually picked different kids to speak on behalf of each animal. And to get up and give a campaign speech and say, this is why you should pick my animal. Now, this I should add, by the way, that there were some write-in votes. The monkeys did really well, even though they weren't on the ballot. But ultimately, we got the panther.
You're listening to a conversation that we had with environment reporter Craig Pittman at Books and Books in Coral Gables. He's the author of this month's Sundial Book Club title, Cattail. You can join our book club by going to Facebook and searching the Sundial Book Club. Let's return to that conversation.
Have you ever seen a panther? Live, in the wild.
Not in the wild, no. It's on my Florida bucket list, but no, I have not seen one in the
wild.
But
you have seen one.
I've seen four in captivity and one that had been run over.
I want to ask the audience, anybody here ever seen a Florida panther in the wild?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've lived in Florida 40 years and I haven't, so, mm-hmm. you know, it's on my list as well.
There aren't any in Coral Gables, I think that's the problem.
Yeah.
That we know of.
That's true.
That we know of.
All right, so look, I mean, you know, we've heard the numbers over and over, mm-hmm. over the years, that at one point it was almost extinct. Mm-hmm. Now there's way less than 200, right?
They estimate between 120 and 230.
Okay.
But the point is, the official estimate in 1995 was 20 to 30, and now we've got 10 times that many. So they're clearly doing better now than they were before. They're not doing great, but they're doing better.
And this is the challenge for the state,
yeah.
is how to protect them. They have they're in their territory, but we're also driving through that territory.
Right. And now the legislature wants to build a whole bunch of toll roads, one of which would cut right through what's left of panther habitat.
They've tried reducing the speed limit, but that hasn't really helped.
No. The only thing that really helps are the underpasses that they built, but those are really expensive to add onto the roads. And I should mention, by the way, the first time they built an underpass for the panthers, the DOT was very skeptical that this would work. And so the state biologists put cameras down there with motion sensors so they could detect what animals were using it. And they found, yes, sure enough, panthers were using the underpasses, and so were a lot of other wildlife, bears, foxes, raccoons, and one guy in a gorilla suit. This is Florida. It's going to happen.
most panthers, though, we tend to find down in the southern part near Cypress, Big Cypress.
Yeah, really, Backahatchee Strand.
But
that
there
area.
Are some that they have spotted up further north.
Well, the males are very wide ranging animals, and we had one that actually went all the way from Collier County up to Georgia before a deer hunter unfortunately saw it and freaked out and shot it. He was prosecuted, by the way. But the males travel a long way. And that's part of the reason why it's tough to protect their habitat, because they need so much room to roam around.
What do you think about the future for the panther?
When I said I was waiting for a good ending, what I meant was a hopeful ending.
Okay.
And the book, I'm not going to say it has a happily ever after by any means, but it has a hopeful ending to it. Panthers are very adaptable animals. They're part of the puma population, which I think exists on every continent except Antarctica. And the way it's been warming up, they may move there too. But they're very adaptable, they're very resilient, and as long as we continue sort of paying attention to what would help them, I think that's the key.
All right, so I mean, I'll be a little bit of the naysayer, because I mean, one of the chapters talked about the fact that we just keep developing. Mm-hmm. It's just Florida keeps developing.
Right.
This is a story of Florida Gulf Coast University.
Yes.
And
well, that was sort of the poster child.
The state wants to build a university, mm-hmm. and a very wealthy man says, "I've got some land. You
Ben
can have
Hill Griffin III.
Ben Hill Griffin III. Mm-hmm. Who, speaking of Florida, his father's name is
on the stadium at UF.
At UF.
Yeah.
He had all this land in Southwest Florida. Says mm-hmm. you can have it. And they wanted to build the university.
Right.
But a lot of people said this is a terrible place because there were panthers living
well,
there.
And it was really, really swampy as well. In fact, there was some speculation that the reason he donated is because he couldn't build on it. But he wanted to build on all the land around where the university would be. And this would give him the perfect excuse. It would be a seed that would sprout all kinds of development. And so initially, the Fish and Wildlife Service was going to say no to this. And the Corps of Engineers also, which is in charge of protecting wetlands. And he called in some favors. He called in favors from the state's Republican senator at the time, Connie Mack, and from the Democratic senator, a guy named Bob Graham, who had a sterling environmental credentials, but here's a major campaign contributor asking for help. And so they convened a meeting at the Fish and Wildlife Service regional office in Atlanta and overturned what the ones in Florida had said. Their reasoning, which they wrote out in a memo, was Florida will be developed.
That's why I'd be a little bit of the devil's advocate in that you have, because you pointed it out in the book, you have politicians who, yes, on one side it's like, well, we got to do the right thing and protect
right.
the habitat.
But panthers don't vote.
Protect the Everglades.
Or make campaign contributions.
And then on the other side you have mm-hmm. them, when you got a guy that wealthy who can make mm-hmm. a couple of calls, mm-hmm. make this happen.
Yeah.
I mean, so how are you hopeful? So hopeful.
Well, bear in mind that at the same time the feds were doing that, they were also buying up land to create the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, which is not huge, but it's a start. They actually preserved some land from development specifically to save the panther. And they hired a guy who was in charge of cultivating the deer herd there to attract panthers there because that's their favorite thing to eat. I mean, Panthers love deer the way I love Oreo cookie ice cream. So that has actually been a big success.
I got to ask you about this. I can't let you go without talking about Skunk Ape. First of all, remind everybody of what...
Do you guys know who the Skunk Ape is?
Yeah. Okay, good.
Okay, all right. Florida, as far as I can tell, is the only state that has not one but two Bigfoot relatives living here. We've got the Barden Booger in Central Florida. And then, of course, we have the fabulous odoriferous Skunk Ape in South Florida. And the Skunk Ape makes an appearance in this book, or rather the guy who owns the Skunk Ape Research Headquarters in Okeechobee. Research Headquarters meaning you can buy t-shirts there. And in addition, he and his brother have a petting zoo there and a campground. And I mentioned the campground because I found out recently that that's where a lot of the python hunters stay during the day. They stay at the Skunk Ape Research Headquarters campground when they're not out, you know, battling these big invasive snakes. But at they had a panther that was treating their petting zoo like it was the buffet at Golden Corral. And so they decided they were going to catch it. And so they staked out a goat that they were going to, you know, try and tempt the panther. And, well, of course, that's animal cruelty, and they wound up being criminally charged for it. Apparently no skunk apes were harmed during this, though. That's the good news.
There is an effort to protect the wildlife. Yes. We're trying to restore the Everglades, the coral reefs in the Keys, and the Florida panther. But I don't know. I mean, do you think we are doing enough?
Here's the thing. Since the 2010 BP oil spill, and even more so with the red tide algae bloom we had that went for 16 months, I think people in Florida are starting to realize that in Florida, at least, the environment is the economy. And if you screw up the environment, you're going to screw up the economy. I mean, lots and lots of people suffered terrible economic losses as a result of both the oil spill and the red tide bloom. And it has become a sort of a potent political effort to try and get the government to do something about this. I mean, we actually saw people heckling Rick Scott when he was running for senator, calling him Red Tide Rick. They actually heckled him into leaving one of his campaign events because they were so angry. And meanwhile, Ron DeSantis, as a candidate, said, I'm going to do something about the algae blooms. We're going to convene task forces. We're going to spend money on research. And he has actually followed up on that. Now, is he going to do the things that the task forces recommend? We'll find out when that happens. But the fact that that's now a potent political issue, I think, should give us all some hope.
I know this book just came out, but yes. What's the next one? What are you working on?
I would love to write a book about the pythons, but okay. I don't know what the ending is. I mean, maybe them swallowing the entire state.
Craig Pittman, it's such a pleasure. Again, it's great to have you as our February title. Ladies and gentlemen, Craig Pittman.
Thank you.
That was Tampa Bay Times environment reporter Craig Pittman. He's also, again, the author of this month's Sundial Book Club title. His book, Cattail, follows the story of the Florida panther. Now, we asked some of our book club members, have they ever seen a Florida panther live in the wild? And some of you responded. Mark Hedden saw three at the same time, once, a mother and two cubs. Mark, I'm so jealous. Tabara Lush says, I wish. Adrian Gonzalez says, I have, on the beach 10 years ago while at Lauderdale by the sea, right at the end by the sand. Don Davies, I saw one once when I was a kid. We had a cabin in the Everglades. Well, I am jealous. 40 years living in Florida, never have seen one in the wild. I hope to do so at some point in my life. You can always join our book club by going to Facebook. Just search Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. Let us know if you're reading the book, what you think about it. Also, tell us about some of the other things that you're reading right now. Well, that is Sundial for this Tuesday, February 11th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Maris. Don't forget that you can download a podcast of this program always. You can listen whenever you want to. Just search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. All right, well, tomorrow there is no Sundial. We have a special best-of program because of the school board meeting, so no live show. But coming up on Thursday, back in 1969, eight black college students staged an eight-day sit-in at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. That sit-in spurred conversations around the country about representation on college campuses. That sit-in is the focus of a new book, Seven Sisters and a Brother. Marilyn Holyfield was one of those activists and wrote a chapter in the book, and she'll join us in studio. Also on the show, we're going to be talking about how safe it is to walk and bike around South Florida. A 2017 National Highway Traffic Safety Administration report found that Florida is the most dangerous in the country for cyclists. Are our streets safe for people who don't drive cars? What more could we or should we be doing to make it safer? Send us, by the way, your story, your experience. Just text us 305-602-2646. Again, 305-602-2646. Let us know. Tell us your story about what it's like for you daily when you're biking or walking or making your way around town. Standard messaging rates apply, by the way. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Again, tomorrow, Best of Show. We're back live on Thursday.